There are some men who are intellectuals that fail at being entertainers, and some men who are entertainers that fail dismally at being intellectuals. But this man is a rare breed because he is both an intellectual and an entertainer. He runs one of the best YouTube channels on the platform, and he is both funny and insightful. We were with him last night and he regaled us with wonderful after-dinner speeches, which I'm asking him not to make now because they're a little bit too fruity, but I hope he will entertain you nonetheless. Edward Dutton. Yeah.
Well, hello, hello, hello. Thank you all for turning up. And I've been looking around the audience today, and it put me in mind of something, which was that when I started, I did a PhD on the anthropology of religion at the University of Aberdeen, and I did field work on fundamentalist Christian students. And I remember at the first meeting I went to, the president of the Christian Union, which is a religious group, got up and said, "People think that people want to join the Christian Union because Jesus inspires them to. That may be true. But the main reason is because the Christian Union has all the best birds." and there was a degree, I'd noticed that, I'd often noticed that. What was it about these Christian girls when I was at university? They didn't wear much makeup, they didn't dress that well or whatever, but there was something about them. They were attractive, they were good looking. What was going on? And I had friends that said, "Ed, you know all these Christian Union people, you have all these friends in the Christian Union, they're so fit. Well, do you think any of them have sex with me?" And I said to my friend Ollie, I said, "No, they're not going to have sex with you, Ollie, because you're not a Christian. I mean, marry them and maybe then, I mean, if you're good. But in general, it's not going to occur unless you convert." But there was something about them. Why are they so good looking? I was thinking about that. And I've been thinking about it for quite a while. What is it about them that's good looking? And similarly, I've noticed that other nationalist and right-wing meetings or whatever, nationalist meetings that I've attended, that you stand up here like this and talk and you look around and there's just so many cracking birds. I mean, well done to you all. I look out and there's just so many bloody sirens. And how good it is to see so many of them here today. And I thought, what's going on? And then I thought, well, if you think about the typical SJW girl, if you think about the typical left-wing girl, then there she is, her hair fake purple, her large spectacles, her bingo wings are waving. Keep your hate speech off our campus! Keep your hate speech off our campus! And I thought, well, why is it? Why is it that SJWs, pardon me, but why are SJWs just such ugly bastards? What is it about this? Is it merely a stereotype? Is it just something that we say because we're bitter and we hate them or whatever? Or is it actually true? Is there a relationship between your political viewpoint or your religious viewpoint, basically being right wing, being left wing, and how good looking you are? Now, would this explain why these Christian birds were just so fit, mate? Yeah. And so I started looking into the evidence. And there was a great deal of evidence in this direction. So firstly, there was a study by a Swedish team, of all teams, a Swedish team, led by a chap called Berggren. And he looked at politicians in Australia, and he got people to rate them for how good-looking they were, and in particular, the symmetry of their face. And symmetry is something we find attractive, and we find it attractive because if you have symmetry, you're meant to be symmetrical, otherwise we'd lop over. And it means you've managed to maintain a symmetrical phenotype in the face of all of the diseases and whatever that life has thrown at you. And so it means that you have good genes. It means that you have a low level of mutational load. It means you are genetically healthy. And so people, of course, find genetic health attractive because they want to pass on their genes. And if you breed with a genetically healthy person, you're more likely to pass on your genes. People find it attractive. They rated the symmetry, and they rated also various ratio averages, and they found that right-wing people are more physically attractive, objectively more physically attractive than left-wing people. They have more symmetrical faces. There was another study, again, this was an American data. It looked at people that vote Republican or Democrat. And this is interesting because it's in a context in which a lot of people that are poor or whatever vote Republican. There was one argument that if you're right-wing, you're more attractive and you get along easier in life, and so you're more likely to vote conservative and you're less likely to vote for sort of socialist parties. But that seems to me to be undermined by this research. research, which looks at Republican v. Democrat, and it controls for race, and it found exactly the same thing. Republican voters are objectively, physically more attractive than Democrat voters. They have objectively more symmetrical faces, more these better ratios. They're just more good-looking. And I thought, oh, well, this could possibly relate to the religiousness issue, because, you know, you can measure religiousness. You can give people surveys in which you ask them how much they believe in God on a Likert scale, or how often they go to church on a Likert scale. You can find out how religious they essentially are. Now, this scale, what's known as the fundamentalist scale, correlates with what's known as the right-wing authoritarian scale, that's a measure of your political values from right to left, at 0.75. Now, that in science is a very high correlation. 0.1, 100%, one variable always goes with the other. 0.75, 75%. So they're very, religiousness and being right-wing are very strongly the same thing. Not completely the same thing, but they're very strongly the same thing. And you've got this strong correlation. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? Could that potentially mean that right-wing people have lower mutational load, are genetically healthier, are basically the genetic norm, and left-wing people, not to put too fine a point on it, are mutants? And I thought about this more, and I thought about, well, in terms of evolution, let's look at the nature of religion. How does religion work? Have we been selected to be religious under Darwinian conditions? Is that what's happened? Well, let's look into this possibility. And so that's what I did. Now, there's every reason to think that religiousness has been selected for. Religiousness is a human universal. Religiousness is heritable. When you get twin studies and you can get identical twins and you can compare them to non-identical twins and you can have identical twins raised apart and this kind of thing. And so you can control for genes. And what we find with these identical twins is that religiousness is about 40% point four, heritable. So we've got that it's heritable. We've got that it is a human universal. It also correlates with fertility. Religious people tend to have more children than non-religious people. It correlates, as I shall go into in more detail in a minute, with health. So there was religious people are healthier, they are physically healthier, and they are mentally healthier than non-religious people. And there are specific areas of the brain that light up during religious experiences. All of this indicates it is something that has been selected for. Now, why would it be selected for? Well, it seems to correlate also with conscientiousness, i.e. rule-following, and agreeableness, i.e. being altruistic and a nice person. Now, these things are obviously going to be selected for under Darwinian conditions, because if you're a nasty person and you don't follow the rules, you're going to be killed by the band. So anything that would make you a nicer person would, of course, be selected for. And what we find is that when religious people conceive of a god that's looking after them, a moral god that's telling them what to do and it's telling them to be moral, well, if you had that adaptation, you'd be more likely to be nice, you'd be less likely to be killed by the band. And we know from experimental research that if people think they're being watched, they behave in a more pro-social way. So that may be one reason why it's come along. It is also correlated with stress. When you become more stressed, you become more instinctive, you become more religious. People tend to become more religious if their parent dies or whatever. They start to see the world in terms of causation and in terms of a hidden hand behind the scenes. And so this again implies it's selected for, because when something is an instinct, when something is a cognitive bias, it tends to be because it's been selected for. So religious people more healthy. This is implying, potentially, that right-wing people are more healthy. These things are true of right-wing people as well. Anyway, I gathered together a lot of the data on this, and what I found was quite interesting. I found that there were a number of markers in which religious people indicated low mutational load, signs of low mutational load, and non-religious people indicated signs of high mutational load, i.e. that this really was something to do with mutation from a norm. So I started looking into this more, and one of the things that I found, interestingly, was people that believe in the paranormal. So they don't believe in God, and they don't collectively worship a moral god, but they believe in the paranormal. Those people are more likely to have hands that are asymmetrical. Now this was interesting, because normally you'd expect a not very good looking body to correlate with a not very good looking face, which would be consistent with what I was noticing with these Christians, that they were very good looking. I'm familiar, of course, with the concept of the Bob Fock. Body off Baywatch, face off Crime Watch. But in general, as I understand it, a female that has a good body will often have a good face. So these things seem to go together. And another researcher, well, Capinella again, found that women who were liberal were less feminine looking. So this again fitted in, less conventionally feminine looking, more masculine looking, if they were liberal. There was a researcher called Nicholas Rule. He tested skin quality, and he found that religious people had better skin quality, controlling for other factors that might influence the perception, than did non-religious people. Now, the biggest research into this was done by a guy called Koenig. And what he found was, again and again, on every measure you can think of, religious people are more mentally healthy. Religious people are less likely to suffer from... and when I say religious people, I mean people that believe in God and go to church and collectively worship him. I.e. do what almost everybody in this country did until 1800. Everybody. So then that's quite interesting, because we were under intense Darwinian selection until the Industrial Revolution. With the Industrial Revolution, it changed. But until the Industrial Revolution, because you have better inoculations, better health, better medicine, better public health, whatever, and so the Industrial Revolution changed things, and Darwinian selection collapsed. And we went from 40% child mortality in 1800 to 1% today. So, obviously, that's the turning point. And what was the norm in 1800 was that collectively worship a moral god. And this is associated with being more physically healthy. People who are religious in this way are less likely to get cancer. They're more likely to recover from cancer if they do get cancer. They're less likely to become depressed. They are more likely to have a gene form which is negatively correlated with suffering from depression. So this implies it's not that, oh, they go to church and they're with a lot of nice people and they sing songs that makes them happy. They actually are genetic. The gene that makes you less depressed is together with the gene that makes you, the genes or whatever that make you religious, which implies they've been selected for, of course. More mentally healthy. And I looked at all of these things that were associated with it. And you find that religious people are less likely to be autistic. Now, autism is a marker of mutation. It's a mark of elevated mutational load. And people who suffer from autism, you will tend to see, in a severe way, you will tend to see markers of this, physical markers. Because you've got to remember that the brain is 88% of the genome. And I look at this in my book, How to Judge People by What They Look Like, shameless plug there. But it's 88% of the genome. And this means that it's a massive target for mutation. And so consequently, if there is some kind of mutation of the body, it's almost certainly going to parallel a mutation of the mind. You only need to look at Greta Thunberg to see a really excellent example of this process. She has a small, she has this dysmorphic face, small nose, small eyes, epicanthic eye folds, attached earlobes, and all of these other markers of mutational load. So autism is what would be one thing. And what I found was that religious people are much less likely to be autistic. We also know that the older a father is, the more likely he is to have an autistic son. And this is because semen quality gets worse with age, and so you're more likely to have de novo mutations, which cause autism in the child. A second thing that we looked at was obviously depression. Yes, people who are atheists are more likely to be autistic. They're more likely also to suffer from depression. They're more likely to be childless, which is the ultimate in basic evolutionary terms. Well, it's more complex with humans because you can pass on your genes indirectly through kin selection or through group selection, as so many of you are doing just by being here. Group selection, your extended phenotype, the ethnic group, you know, the one way in which one can pass on one's genes. They are less likely to have children. They are more likely to be left-handed. I'm left-handed, I should note, but normally left-handedness is associated with elevated mutational load. There is a degree to which the brain is evolved to be symmetrical. If the brain is symmetrical, you will be normally right-handed. If the brain is asymmetrical and skewed, you will be left-handed. So left-handedness is associated with mutational load and all kinds of psychosocial problems, homosexuality. Transsexuals are about 50% left-handed. and it's not an exaggeration. They are about 50%. I don't know why you're laughing. It's all true. 50% left-handed. Atheists are more likely to be left-handed. And so what this is implying, I mean, there are good-looking exceptions to this. I mean, you can think of... But what this is basically implying is an issue of mutation. We're talking about this issue of mutation. So I thought about... And stereotypes, remember, are normally correct. So I thought to myself, well, what's going on with this? You know, what's the issue? Religiousness is being selected for. We can see it's been individually selected for. It's probably been sexually selected for as well, because women will tend to sexually select. Women, of course, have something to lose from the sexual relationship, and so they want to sexually select for a male who will look after them, you know, who won't simply pump and dump, as I believe the phrase has it. And of course, religiousness is a marker of this, because religiousness means that they are rule-following, that they are moral, that they are more likely to stay and look after them and whatever. So it will be selected for in terms of sexual selection. The other way round, a man, if he's going to invest in the female, he wants to make sure he's not cuckolded. He wants to make sure she's not a slapper. And so if she's religious, again, you would expect this to be selected for. And then finally, you get the issue of group selection, which is the idea that you pass on your genes through kin selection, through looking after your nieces and nephews, the spinster auntie or whatever, but also you can pass it on through your extended phenotype, your ethnic group. And Frank Salter has done a lot of research on this. If you divide the world into only English and only French, then a random Englishman is going to be more genetically similar to another random Englishman than to a random Frenchman. And this will mean that in a situation of war, there will be a motive in terms of his genetic interests to lay down his life for his extended phenotype. This is group selection. This is an extension of kin selection. And we know from computer models, and they've run these again and again and again, that if you set up different kinds of group, the humanitarian group, where you help everybody in a prisoner's dilemma one-shot game, the group where you're traitors and you only help the other group, a group where you're individualists and you help nobody, or a group where you're ethnocentric, i.e. you help your own side and you fight the other side, that group always eventually dominates the grid. In group selection, it's ethnocentric groups that dominate the grid. And religiousness, in the traditional sense, tends to correlate with ethnocentric attitudes. And indeed, if you look at what religiousness is doing, it often takes ideas which are basically evolutionarily adaptive ideas. Pass on your genes, look after your family, fight the outsider, whatever it happens to be, and it makes those the will of God, such that they are more likely to be obeyed. So religiousness can be understood as a group-selected issue, and therefore selected for that reason as well. And so for all of these reasons, what I was coming to the conclusion was that we have the best girls in nationalist movements, and they have the best girls in the Christian Union, because those people who perhaps make up about 10% of the population are a remnant normal population. They are the people who would have survived under the intense Darwinian conditions that were present in Europe in 1800. And those of us in this room indeed, and the other 90% of the population, the mutants, would for the most part never ever have been born. And their parents would never have been born. And their grandparents would never have been born. They are cultural and genetic garbage. And if you are ever feeling black-pilled, then you can white-pill yourself by realizing that we are the 10%ers. The 10%, not the 1%ers, the 10%ers who would have survived conditions of Darwinian selection. And this brings me to why. Why is it that you have these deviants, these people, this multiculturalism, what other speakers have talked about today, what Woese was talking about in terms of metaphysical evil, what Frode and Laura were talking about in terms of sort of methods to use to confront it or whatever it was, or what all of you have been talking about, what Hugh was talking about, what Golden Boy, all talked about a similar issue, which is how has this happened? Is it some kind of god of evil that's taking over the universe? Perhaps. Or is there some more scientific explanation? Well, I like to think that there's a more scientific explanation. And my colleague, with whom I often have a live stream on my channel, The Jolly Heretic, Michael Woodley of Manee, it's very much his idea, he calls it the social epistasis model. And that idea is this. Until 1800, Industrial Revolution, we were under conditions of Darwinian selection, 40% child mortality every generation. It wasn't 40% child mortality across the board, of course. It was maybe 80% child mortality among poorer people because they had worse conditions and so on. And it was lower child mortality among wealthier people, but on average 40% child mortality. This goes down to 1% child mortality over 200 years. Now, what is this going to result in? Well, who are the children that are going to die? It's going to be the children who have got poor immune systems. It's going to be the children who have got high mutational load. Mutational load, which means they're not healthy. They can't survive measles. They can't survive typhus, whatever, and they die. But remember that the brain is 88% of the genome. So if they've, and it's a massive target for mutation. So if they've got mutations of the body, these will be comorbid with mutations of the mind. And so as all these people and their children and their grandchildren who would never have survived under Darwinian conditions have lived and passed on their genes, not only has there been a build-up of physical mutations in the population, and we know this, I mean, we've even got records of skulls across time, representative samples, we're becoming, our faces are becoming less asymmetrical across time. We are literally becoming physically uglier across time. We know this. But it would mean there would be a build-up of mental mutations, of ways of thinking genetically underpinned, which under Darwinian conditions would get you killed, would mean that you as an individual would not pass on your genes, would mean that your family would not pass on their genes, and would mean ultimately that the group of which you were a part, your ethnic group, would not pass on their genes. Under Darwinian conditions, these were selected out via high child mortality. Now they are not selected out. And remember, by the way, that the heritability of political opinion, right or left, has been estimated to be as much as 0.6. So it's highly genetic. So what you're going to get is what I call the rise of the mutants. You're going to get more and more people with these maladaptive ideas. Look after other ethnic groups ahead of your own. Don't have babies. Don't believe your life has eternal significance. Go and bloody kill yourself. Wipe out mankind. Feel guilty for breeding. Antinatalism and all this bollocks. This is what you would expect. I used that in the traditional Greek sense. This is what you would expect to occur. But it gets worse. Because we are highly social animals. People compare humans to chimpanzees. They shouldn't compare humans to chimpanzees. E.O. Wilson, the Harvard zoologist, argued that we should be compared to ants or bees, eusocial insects. We're highly, highly social. And what that means is that with us, we're so social, we're so intermingled as a species, that if you find yourself with somebody who is a mutant, then they will cause even your genes to be suboptimally expressed. And a good example of this is depression. There's research indicating that depression is literally contagious. If you spend a lot of time with a person suffering from depression, you will become depressed, or there's an elevated likelihood of that. And the reason for that is because we are evolved to be with genetically normal people. And so obviously if we're not with those people, we're not in the conditions to which we're adapted, and this will cause our genes to be suboptimally expressed. And if this spreads throughout the society, then the genes of the whole society start to become, in many cases, suboptimally expressed. An example would be bees. Let's say there's the feeder cast of the bee, and she gives too much to this larvae and too little to this larvae, and you end up with too many queens and not enough drones and too many workers. And then you have another hive that it's not mutated. There's no mutant feeder cast member. And so that hive is more adaptive. And so it destroys the other hive in the battle for resources. This would be an example of this. And this you can see with us. So the mutants will get into positions of power in the society, and they will influence even those who are not the mutants to behave maladaptively. A good example of this can be seen in something like feminism. So these mutants get into a position of power in the society, and they tell women that if you are just a housewife and a good mother, you're a loser, you're pathetic, you're a waste of time. And so therefore you get all of these women, intelligent women at least, who dedicate all of their 20s, and increasingly even the first half of their 30s, to their careers. And then they find that they can't have children, they've left it too late, or they only have one or two. While a less intelligent woman has left school at 16 and had loads of children by a series of unsuitable men, and she's becoming a grandmother by the time this woman is becoming a mother. So not just more children, but more generations. The result of this, by the way, is that we are getting less intelligent, and which is another factor. So this is what's going on. Whether it's feminism, multiculturalism, they rise men to a position and they tell people, oh, you know, you shouldn't. It's wrong to look out for your own race, your own genetic interests. You feel guilty about it, you don't do it, or whatever it happens to be. Now, this is what my colleague calls them, spiteful mutants, because they cause the whole superorganism to behave in a maladaptive way. And this is what we are seeing. This is what we are seeing today. And a good example of this, this was done with mice. There was an experiment on mice, which you may have heard of, Calhoun, in the University of Maryland, 1968 to 73. They put these mice in a colony, a perfect heaven for mice. They took away all predation, all Darwinian selection. First of all, there was a massive spike in population, just like we saw in the Industrial Revolution. Then the population spike started to slow down. And then weird things were noticed. Females had to pester males for sex. Females would throw their litter throw their babies out of the nest too young, and they wouldn't develop social skills, and they wouldn't end up breeding. More and more males were these autistic weirdos that would just groom each other and be scared of women and have nothing to do with them and just drink water all the time. They were known as the beautiful ones. And this carried on. And within a few years, all the females were either these aggressive butch lesbians that didn't want anything to do with men, or they were beautiful males, or they were socially inept, and eventually the colony had no more children and it died out. But the different, and this is what we're seeing with the argument is that that's what these mice were. These mice were mutants. The mutations were not being washed out of the population, the weird non-mouse behaviour that was not being purged from the population every generation. The result was a rise in these mutant mice. It was influencing even the non-mutant mice to behave in a maladaptive way, and so consequently the whole population collapsed. And that is what we are seeing today. That is what is happening to us. We are in a situation with the rise of the mutants, and they are influencing people who are open to being inculcated, people who are highly intelligent maybe as well, because intelligence seems to predict being able to work out the way the wind is blowing and work out what's in your interests in terms of money and this kind of thing, and so you're more likely to adopt the dominant ideology, which if it's multiculturalism, and so intelligent people tend to do that. And so these people who would have had children in days of old are not having them. Intelligence is going down, society is becoming less ethnocentric, society is becoming this clown world of madness, and everything is falling apart. Now, in saying that, I would like to note that I do understand that basically society ends up with an instinct to destroy itself because normal instincts are no longer widespread. Now, in saying that, I do appreciate that some of you might be thinking that there is in this speech a little bit too much negativity. a little bit too much in the way of black pills or whatever it is. But there is a fundamental difference between ourselves and mice, beyond the fact of, you know. And that is that in the case of the mice, there was John Calhoun, there was someone there to keep the experiment going so that they died out. Whereas we are in charge of our own zoo. And that is the fundamental difference. And that is why, in wrapping up, I would like to stress that I've got 10 minutes. There is an element of hope. Because as I noted earlier, these people who, the atheists, those who are left-wing, those who are involved in all of this stuff, these people don't breed. They don't have babies. There are two kinds of people who have babies today. Religious people, which I would suggest right-wing, as we said, is broadly associated with, religious people, and stupid people. Those are the people who breed. Now, religious people tend to be highly ethnocentric. They funnel this through notions of God or whatever it happens to be. Basically, they are. It correlates in general, though there is a degree to which the modern Church of England has been completely fallen to the communists. And if you've read Justin Welby's latest book, I can't remember what it's called. It's basically Marxism in a mitre. But you know, that aside, traditional religious people. They have this inclination to breed, they want to breed, and they do breed. So they are the ones that are passing on their genes. That's the first thing. The second thing is that having low IQ seems to correlate with ethnocentric attitudes. And that is the case among the European population, among the white population. Somebody was asking me, I was talking to a lady earlier about the problem of the middle class. And it's an interesting issue, actually, if you think about that these spiteful mutants come from the middle class, often. And that's to be expected. Because, of course, Darwinian selection stopped first with the people at the higher end of society. And then it made its way down. The conditions were harsher for the working class than the upper class. And so you'd expect the upper classes to be more mutated than the lower classes. And so on that basis, you would expect these ideas to manifest from the higher classes. And there is it was found by Gregory Clark in his book, The Sun Also Rises, the heritability of social class in this country across from 1200 to 1950 was 0.7. So it's very social classes are essentially castes. And so you'd expect it to work in that way. And other research he's done has indicated that basically the values of the upper class were these paternalistic values, and those were also the values of the lower class, and the values of the middle class were individualistic values. And he shows through wills that what predicts having the most babies that survive across the period is being middle class. Not being upper class, they're being wiped out in battles and things. They're not passing on their genes. Not being working class, they're dying of diseases and things. Being middle class. So these individualistic values expand and expand and expand. And you'd expect, therefore, these problems to start in the middle class. And that's what seems to have happened. But anyway, the point is that we know who's breeding. It's religious people, it's people who are low in intelligence, and it's K-strategists, what we call K-strategists, people that are interested in family and investing in their offspring and following the rules and these kinds of people. That's who's people, in other words, like ourselves. That's who's breeding. So in a simple battle of evolution, it implies that the people who are of the mutants are gradually not passing on their genes. So that's one reason to be positive. A second reason, but that's a very long-term reason. A more short-term reason to be positive is obviously that we are not so mutated yet as a people that we are completely mad. And when people are pushed too far, what happens? They feel stressed. If they feel stressed, they become more religious. If they become more religious, they become more ethnocentric. If they feel stressed, they also become more instinctive. And one of the instincts we seem to have been selected to have is a desire to maintain our genetic interests, not only at the individual level, but also at the group level. That's quite clear from experimental data done by J. Philippe Rushton, which you can look into afterwards. I mean, friends, for example, are more genetically similar than would be possible by chance. Parents invest more in offspring that are more genetically similar to them than in offspring that are less genetically similar to them. People operate along lines of genetic similarity. And so what this means is we're going to get a reaction. People can only be pushed so too far. And it's evidently happening. And you can see this with Trump, as was mentioned earlier by a golden boy. No, one. You can see this golden gentleman. You can see this with Trump. You can see this with Brexit. And you can see this with the fact that something like this has been possible. If you'd have told me only a few years ago that I'd be standing talking at a conference organised by Mark Collett, that evil man with his hate cockroaches speech stuff, malarkey, I'd have said, don't be ridiculous. I'm a good man, he's a bad man. But no, you're here, we're here, it's happening, and I am confident, as someone once said, that it's the mood is changing, it will change for genetic reasons, it's a genetic inevitability that there will be a backlash. Also, as society becomes less intelligent, then all of these things that we won't be able to do that we used to be able to do, people again become more instinctive, more stressed, and ethnocentrism will rise back again. As somebody once said, behind us marches an angry people, are people who feel betrayed, despised, thrown on the scrap heap. But those people are now fighting back. Fighting back to take back what belongs to them. Our country. And we will take it back. Thank you very much. I just want to ask Laura to say a few words.
That was a fantastic speech, Ed. So I won't keep you very long because we know that guys have got to run off and get the trains and stuff. But Ed and I just wanted to say on behalf of us and on behalf of everybody else in the room, if you allow us to say this, which I think you will, we just wanted to say thank you to you, Mark. And Mark's somebody who works continuously for us. He's somebody who gets beating after beating after beating from the mainstream media, and every time it happens he just stands up, dusts himself off and carries on. And I don't know how he finds the time to do all the stuff that he does, but what a fantastic guy, ladies and gents. Thank you, Matt.
Well, thank you, Laura, and thank you, everyone. And that was a perfect way to end what's been a perfect day. That was a magnificent speech, one of the best I've ever heard. We've got a few little points to say first before we close the meeting. I will be speaking in Copenhagen twice. Once with Frode on the
October the 12th.
So if you'd like a ticket to see me speak in Copenhagen, then speak to Frode. And again on November the 9th, significant date. If you want a ticket, speak to that gentleman there. Now, next, I realise people have to get home. So a lot of people here, I think the majority are staying for the meal. If you're not staying for the meal and you have space in your car and you can give somebody a lift to the train station who doesn't have a vehicle, that would be super appreciated. So I know a few of you, if you're going and you have a car, could I have a show of hands? Anyone who's going has got a car? Yeah, if you need a lift, center in on those guys and they will give you a lift to the station if you need a lift to the station. And that would be super helpful. Thank you very much. And I just want to say it has been a fantastic day. Now, at this point, if this was an old-style meeting or a sort of Tommy Robinson-style rally, I would be shilling for cash. Now, these things do run at a loss, but I'm not actually going to ask you for any money. If, however, you want to leave a small contribution to the hotel staff, because they've been absolutely fantastic, anyone that wants to leave a small contribution on the table over there, it will be given to the girls who've worked so hard to, just as a tip, for making this day run so smoothly, because they've been super helpful, super courteous. They've sort of made sure all the courses and all the food and everything's come out exactly when it was needed, despite some of the speeches running over or finishing early. So if you can do that, if you want to leave a small contribution, that won't go to us or the organisers. We're not asking for anything more. That will go to the girls who work in the hotel. So that just leaves me to say, I think it's been a wonderful day. I hope all of you have really enjoyed yourself. I hope you all feel this is the start of something new and exciting. And the good news is we won't be doing this again just once a year, but we hope to do this twice a year. Once in the spring in the south, and once in the autumn in the north, to give a much greater reach so that people who have travelled from places like Portsmouth or south of London don't have to make those long journeys again. I hope you all have a wonderful rest of the conference if you're staying, and if you are making that long journey back tonight, I wish you a safe journey. Thanks to all the speakers, and thank you to all of you for coming. Thank you so much.
Tuned in to